Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I am joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you? How are you this fine spring day? I believe it is the first official day of spring.
Yes, spring has sprung. Many puns, happiness, and growth.
Very good. And we are joined by, I think for the second time on the show, Mr. Gerben van Heerden. From the Center for Risk Analysis, although I believe at the moment he is writing his capacity as an analyst for the Institute of Race Relations. Kerry, how are you doing?
I'm keeping things together. Yes,
that's
I think I should be grateful for everything in my life, yeah.
I think that's a very good way of putting things, especially in what has been an interesting 2 years with COVID and the collapse of civil society in South Africa.
Being grateful every day. Yeah, that's the only way you can make it through this time. Yeah.
100%. Right. So let us get on to our first story. And today is, I think, a day of victory for South Africans and for us at the IRR. And this is to do with the Social Development Minister, Lindiwe Zulu. If you watched the show, I think it was last week, she proposed in a green paper a policy proposal which would see all South Africans forced to give somewhere between 8 and 12% of their incomes to a social security fund, which would be under state management. And considering how it was very likely to shake out, this effectively means a kind of 12% tax on everyone's income, on top of everything you already pay, which obviously was not particularly popular. And the minister has now withdrawn the green paper. And so it looks like, at least for now, the plan is dead. Gabriel, do you want to maybe just go over a little bit why this thing was so silly and also what we can draw from this?
Right. So there's a good faith argument for forcing people to save money through a tax system like this. And that is that you get the best kind of risk management when you have risks pooled in larger numbers. So insurance always works better if there's more people in the insurance company and more finances in the insurance company. So if you force everyone to join, then it's the biggest possible pot. That means you get the best rates of return. You can make the most effective investments with it. And if you think that, people are not rational and prudent and adults who can take care of themselves as government, you think they're kind of like children that need to be helped out, then forcing them to save is going to put them in a better position for old age. That's the argument. Okay, so that's the good faith argument for doing this kind of thing. Here are the problems. Firstly, South Africans have never been taxed at this rate before in the history of the Union of South Africa. So World War II, World War I wars famously increased tax relative to income. The tax burden wasn't as high as it is now. The collapse of apartheid, when the Nats were not only having border wars, but were basically militarizing townships and trying to have a war with most of South Africa, still
and facing international sanctions.
And facing international sanctions, still didn't have as much of a tax problem as we have right now. So we've gotten to the point, and there's a fancy economic term for this, Laffer curve, but never mind that. We've gotten to the point where you can't bleed the stone any more than it's already being bled. There's nothing to pull. The cow is dry, it's empty. You can pull out it. Aziko, Luto, finish, klar, etc. So that's first problem, obvious. Second problem, we can't afford it. Second problem, there's a pension fund industry that exists in this country that allocates assets fairly effectively. It's the last effectively major good thing going. It manages trillions of rands worth of fixed assets. And every South African earning up to 275,000 rand, all of the savings that would be going into the private pension funds instead would be forced into government hands. So that would seriously damage the private pension fund industry, which means that the assets that they already have are going to shrink and have to be rearranged. They're going to have fire sales. It's going to be disruptive to the economy, bad for investment, bad for growth, just like EWC, NHI, and so on and so forth. The third major problem, and I think this is this is kind of a no-brainer that you hardly have to explain to anyone, is when you give an alcoholic more booze, they drink more. When you give a corrupt government more money, they get more corrupt. So that's an issue. If you're redirecting literally over a few years, trillions of rands newly into the hands of a government that has already proven itself incapable of spending at local government level with even basic financial auditing, incapable of spending at national level without doing things like SAA disaster, Denel disaster, Transnet disasters, Eskom disasters, the government would be running something bigger than Eskom and all the other SOEs combined pretty quickly. Thinking that they can do that well, it's not going to work. So Lindiwe Zulu, Minister of Social Development, put out this idea. It was immediately bashed. We went after it. We campaigned against it. We wrote letters to the ministry. We raised petitions. So did Dear South Africa. So did the Democratic Alliance. So did AfriForum. So did the unions. There really was a lot of organs of civil society and the broader body politic getting together to say this is a terrible idea. And it was so obviously a terrible idea that Treasury said it's a terrible idea. You can't do it. The minister was chastised and the bill was withdrawn. So final note, does that mean this is over? Does that mean, hurrah, now we're going to get reasonable government? No. We've seen this before. The Institute of Race Relations led the charge against prescribed assets, which was a very similar push to try and take pension savings away from private investment and force them into sclerotic, corrupt state-owned enterprises. And we were really first out of the gates in fighting that one. And it took years to bring it to bear, to force people to take it seriously, and finally to get enough of a lobby to get it officially dropped. So that was dropped. Then this came. Now this has been dropped. Something else is going to come. And we already have part of it, EWC, NHI, and so on. But part of it might be a reversion to prescribed assets, a reversion to fixing exchange rates, new tariff dispensation. There's ongoing efforts to increase the size of government, decrease the size of your freedom, and we are alive to that. We're on the edge of our seats and on our guard.
So, Kerry, I think you know Gabriel gave a very good summary there, so I don't know how easy it is going to be to follow up, but let's take a crack at it. Do you agree with Gabriel that we're definitely going to see, I guess, a game of bad policy whack-a-mole where this shall be reborn in yet a new horrific version at some point? Do you have anything to add on maybe why government was pursuing something like this, why they're so desperate to get their hands on more of our resources?
Well, I think it's the correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, the National Democratic Revolution that the government tries to pursue, that advocates for the state to have more centrist control over many parts of the economy. So once you understand that, you can kind of understand the ludicrousy in many of the ANC's attempts to, just get more and more. I mean, part of it is, you know, they want access to a great pool of funding for corruption purposes. But I guess another part of it is because they follow this ideology where the state really has to control everything eventually. And, one of my colleagues at the CRA actually said that, you know, this is so counterproductive for the ANC because you're essentially just creating more work for yourself. I mean, establishing all these state-owned enterprises and, you know, just give it to the private sector. It's less work, you know. And so that's the one part of it. I think another part of it is the fact that it's starting to feel to me like the government is just giving up on creating jobs for South Africans. So they're trying to. What I mean by that is that in 2010, that was the last year that we actually had more jobs than social grants. And since then, the number of social grants has increased exponentially, and we need tax money to fund our ever-growing expansive welfare system. But the tax is running out. People are physically immigrating, financially immigrating. So our pool of money is quite smaller, and yet the government is laying on more and more of these state-owned projects that's going to suck the money out of whatever remains of our middle class. And, you know, our middle class is, as you both mentioned, we're paying double tax. Wherever we go, we're actually trying to make moves away from the state, not just middle class South Africans, but those in the more marginalized sections of the South African society. There's no money left, and I think the ANC is in for a rude awakening soon.
I think that's very likely, and we've been saying for a while that one of the theses about where South Africa's headed is that the money problems are going to force some sort of change. Things can't go on as they are now. Mm-hmm. Gabriel, any last words?
Yeah, I saw that comment. Yeah, this is the psychologically important thing to try and hold on to, the sense of victory. Things can work out. We can apply pressure in order to get a victory. But the victory doesn't mean a full-on turnaround. The victory means we get to fight another day. So you got to take that good feeling, and then you've got to apply it next time the fight comes along. And it's kind of the obverse of what the ANC's own internal motto, which is dexterity and tact, firmness in principle. So I think Harry did a good job of laying out it's not just about corruption, it is about ideology, and the principle is to make the state eventually run everything. That is the firm principle that keeps coming back. But the dexterity and tact means if pressure is applied in such a fashion as to point out directly and undeniably the fact that the ANC is out of step with what most people want, with the public interest, then there's a momentary retreat so that the ANC can hold on to the kind of fake idea that it is what most South Africans like when it hasn't had more than basically a quarter of the vote in a while.
To quote from the press statement that you put out today, Gabriel, that eternal phrase, the price of freedom is vigilance. Excuse me. All right, let us move on to our next topic. And this is a report that has been released by us, by the Institute of Race Relations. And it was authored by Gerbrand here. And it is about the voting preferences of LGBT people in South Africa. Gerbrand, do you want to tell us a little bit about, you know, why you wrote this report, what its findings were, and, yeah, what we should take away from it?
We've studied the general population and how they vote in every election. We know how urban and rural provinces vote differently. We know how different demographic groups, age groups vote. But not much is known about the so-called pink vote, which is the voting preferences of the LGBT population. And I think the perception exists that, you know, it's a quite tiny, insignificant population that really can't contribute much to an election. So it often tends to be ignored, or it's because of political indifference. So the goal from this report was basically just to get a better understanding of the local LGBT electorate, and also look at why it's important to consider it. And I think one of the findings that stood out for me was that, you know, LGBT voters tend to be a lot more politically engaged than the general population. They're twice as likely to donate to a campaign. They're twice as likely to contact an elected official or attend a rally or demonstration. Also, the voting bloc may be much larger than expected. A study has shown that there's only like 1.4% of the population, which is considered LGBT. So it's quite tiny, actually. That equates to around 500,000 people or 500,000. But if you take into account that, you know, because of stigma and discrimination and fear of violence, you know, many people don't, you know, freely express their sexual identity or rather their sexual orientation and gender identity, even to researchers. So the true size of the LGBT population and therefore the voting bloc can be expected to be much larger. And also there's this idea that LGBT people only vote for left-leaning, socially left-leaning political parties, you know, liberal parties. They'll never go to no conservative party can ever wish to, you know, win them over to their side. But we've seen in many parts of the world, actually, that's not the case. I'll just briefly mention in Brazil, you know, you had Bolsonaro being elected as president a few years ago in Brazil. And he was considered quite right-wing on many issues. He's made disparaging remarks about LGBT people. He's, you know, he was hostile towards gay marriage. And but in fact, about a third of Brazil's LGBT people ended up voting for him for president and for his administration. And that's because he said that he's going to decisively deal with issues such as corruption, crime, and joblessness, which is huge problems that Brazil has. And that's so huge that many LGBT people were like, you know what? We will vote for a homophobic dude if he could give me a job, or, you know, it's fine. I'll worry about that later. So I think, yeah, it is quite possible for political parties from different ideological backgrounds to court this cohort. I'm afraid I'm a runaway train now. Shall I give Gabriel some?
Well, let me ask one more question. I guess okay. One of the other thoughts is, you know, someone might say the reason that we haven't looked at, you know, sexuality as a way to segment the voting population is because people, they don't really vote on their main issues are not their, you know, related to their sexual orientation. Do you think that's true? How much does people's sexual orientation actually drive their voting behavior, do you think? I mean, you sort of answered a little bit in that thing about Bolsonaro, but
yeah,
more
yeah.
broadly.
Well, you know, we did some mini opinion polls that we included in the report. And, you know, the report showed that, you know, homophobia, or rather, let me take a step back and say that, first of all, the respondents in the survey did say that, you know, homosexuality was, or a party's position on sexual orientation and gender identity was very highly important. But when asked about the question, would you vote for a pro-LGBTQ political party, even if their ideological perspective clashes a lot with your own, many people said no. You know, we need a political party that will cater to many of our needs, not just, you know, say that, not just show up at a gay pride parade and say, hey, we're behind you guys. So I think the point I'm trying to make is that the LGBT voting population in South Africa is pragmatic, and it's a little bit more sophisticated than I think people believe. And yeah, political parties need to, you know, pursue different strategies to attract this cohort, and also realize that it is a valuable and untapped market for political parties. So yeah.
Gabriel, what do you have to add to what Harry said? You've read the report, I believe, or at least most of it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's fascinating that interplay between people wanting to have rights, human rights issues that particularly pertain to themselves, being respected and having attention drawn to it, both at a domestic and foreign policy level. And at the same time, being like, well, this is just one part of my life. And so this is just one part of what I'm looking for from a political party or representative. And the Bolsonaro one was the most extreme example that I could think of. There were others. But he, I mean, he's not just against gay marriage, which is, I think, a wrong position. I mean, it's a wrong position, but I think it's a respectable position. I've had very intelligent debates with people about that. He's also like an outright homophobe, like bad guy. So that's not cool. But as Harry said, some dudes were like, hey, at least I've got a better chance of having a job. That's interesting. I think that it's also worth drawing attention to a little kind of anecdote that came out of me reading the report, which is that I saw Harry analyzed the DA, the EFF, and the ANC in terms of how they've addressed this issue in South African politics. And ANC has been a bit schlumpy about foreign relations, condemning those who those governments that are homophobic in Africa. EFF has been much stronger in that regard. The DA kind of stood out as having the most consistent protection of the rights in question, both in principle and in practice. But there was this interesting point where in the report, Habrand draws attention to those members of the Democratic Alliance, those high up in the DA that are openly gay, walking the walk. And the last one in that list was Mike Waters, who's an MP. And I was like, well, I every time I read about Mike Waters in the news, I found it quite interesting. I wonder what he's up to now. I Googled him and I saw that he had resigned as a member of parliament earlier this year. And I was quite sad to see that. But then I recalled the sort of, I mean, he's had an illustrious and very successful career. And my understanding is that he's still working in DA politics at a grassroots level and doing good work. But he did have a run-in quite a few years ago, which is quite telling. Where another then member of the DA, John Moody, was caught on tape trying to frame him, trying to frame Mike Waters, this openly gay man, as sort of basically bribing people for sex. So there was this, you know, story that comes out, you know, Mike Waters is into sex for jobs, but then it turns out that he's being framed and there's a voice recording of him being framed. And then there's a disciplinary hearing against the guy who's doing the framing, but as with so many things in the DA, the disciplinary hearing never completes, and the public is never afforded the full sort of transparency of light on the issue, and instead Moody steps down and joins Hermes Mashaba's party. And I think it kind of speaks to a challenge with Mashaba's party, and that is that he's in trouble insofar as there are some good people that have defected to his party from the DA for good reasons, but there are others that have defected because they've been kind of washed out and couldn't afford to take the Patricia de Lille route all the way into ANC cabinet. Anyway, I don't want to call anyone a homophobe, but I do think that was an interesting case in maybe taking advantage of a latent homophobia that might still reside in some parts of South Africa's body politic. And that makes Khadran's report quite salient. I think that there are issues and biases there that must be brought to light and must be defended against.
Yeah, no, definitely. So I guess the last question I can ask on this one, Harry, is just about the EFF. You talked about how the EFF had criticized other African leaders being homophobic or passing anti-gay legislation, stuff like that. Do you think that you get the impression that they are very committed to LGBT issues, or are they just sort of kind of going along with the ideological flow? This is a personal question. I'm actually just curious. Mm-hmm.
So, two things on that. Pew Research has actually shown that if I remember correctly, Pew Research has shown that EFF supporters are actually the most open towards people of different sexual orientations and gender identity. So maybe they are marketing to their own support base. I'm not sure about that, but I wouldn't take the EFF too seriously on that topic. And one of the points that I make in my report is that they have very, very close ties with another opposition party in Namibia, which is also very radical, socialist, communist inspired, advocating for the nationalization of everything. But that party in Namibia is extremely, extremely homophobic. They're very, very, they make public disparaging remarks about LGBT people. They really make it clear that gay people do not belong in Africa. And the EFF said that this Namibian opposition party is their ideological offspring. And they want to support that party no matter what. And so I find it contradictory that they're willing to criticize other African countries about the human rights violations that occur there, but then at the same time, they're so vocally supportive of this party. So I guess that's what I have to say about that. Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Anyway, let us move on to our last topic for today, and this is some news coming out. We've talked about this issue, I think, before on the show, so we won't have a huge amount of time to cover it. But basically, there was an accusation made in the Sunday Times a while ago that a recently elected ANC MP, Xiaomei Harvard, had close links to the Communist Party of China. And the accusation was that she was actually a spy for the Communist Chinese Party. Well, it turns out that the South African State Security Agency, which I wasn't sure actually did anything other than spy on internal political opponents, appears to have written a report identifying this ANC MP as probably being in a Chinese government spy. The report was not publicly released. It was leaked by someone in the State Security Agency. To the media, to News 24, I think, specifically. And it said that while it couldn't be 100% sure, it was pretty sure that this ANC MP was working alongside the Chinese Ministry of State Security, the MSS, and was linked to the United Front Work Department, which is a sort of front organization for Chinese intelligence that collects intelligence using the Chinese diaspora across the world. It's worth noting that the ANC MP in question responded to the comments in the to the accusations in the media by saying that she intends to sue the quote ugly people making bad comments about her. Gabriel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not super thrilled about this story. I think that our colleague Terence Corrigan in a previous episode made a very clear case for firstly why we shouldn't fall into the trap of sort of anti-Han Chinese bigotry. At the same time, we should be very worried about Beijing exerting direct influence in our parliament and in our body politic more generally, and that this does seem to be a case where the evidence is inclined to show that that is what's happening. The SSA report, as far as I can tell, and I don't spend as much time sort of holding Ramaphosa's tea cozy as News 24 does, so we haven't yet got direct access to that leak. But as far as I can tell, there's no real hard evidence. It remains circumstantial. In fact, it doesn't go as far as the media reports had already gone. So our SSA, I'm not sure that it's particularly good. I do notice that the ANC can't afford to pay its staff, can't afford to pay its taxes, can't afford to pay its pensions, can't afford to run an election campaign, hoping that thing gets postponed, can't really run itself, let alone the government, let alone the country in a positive direction. With all of that, it needs scapegoats. Ace Magashule was one. Batabile Dlamini's resigning was a sort of great triumph, so to speak. Jacob Zuma going to jail is a great triumph for the ANC. I worry a little bit about this ANC MP being used as a scapegoat. What I would very much like to see is hard and credible evidence. It seems very likely that that hard and credible evidence is available and that it should be found by a proper and professional state security service. And that on the basis of that evidence, she doesn't just get shamed. She gets arrested and taken out of parliament. That would be the right and serious way to go. For her to stay there, but to be unpopular and smeared and slurred, seems like it satisfies no one excepting the ANC, which wants a little bit of a distraction from its policy and systemic issues.
Kerry, any thoughts before we close off? 30 seconds or so?
Not really much, except that, you know, good luck to the ANC for this, because, I mean, this, it's clear that the party, it's like Gabriel said, they can't run themselves, and so how can we expect them to run an entire country, sovereign state? So, yeah, that's all I'll say.
If I can just say, shout out to Moonchild, who always watches our shows and said, give us likes and so on. That is really very good for these videos. Also, shout out to the previous commentator who, when I was rambling about the ANC, said, they can't even run a bath. I quite like that.
Very good. All right. Thank you very, very much to both of you. And thank you to all of our listeners. We hope that you enjoyed the show. We will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. And yeah, please support the Institute of Race Relations. SMS your name to 32823. It's on the banner behind me. And sign up as a friend of the Institute of Race Relations. Anyway, we hope that you thought this was interesting. And we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.